Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is North Carolina Republican David Rauser, who joins us to discuss the response to Hurricane Ian and this week's Supreme Court arguments over wetlands regulation. But first, here's this week's headlines. Oral arguments Monday left the Supreme Court with the task of determining how wetlands should be regulated under the Clean Water Act. The case involves an Idaho couple barred from building a home on their land because the EPA said it violated the Clean Water Act. According to the EPA, the land had wetlands that meet the requirements of navigable waters regulated by the Act. Farm groups are watching the case for a broader test to determine whether or not landowners are subject to Waters of the U.S. rules. The Biden administration also has ongoing rulemaking to address the issue, something farm groups want to see halted while the court deliberates. The inland waterways system is coming into focus for producers looking ahead to their fall harvest. Drought across the country is contributing to low water levels in the Mississippi, Ohio, and Illinois rivers. In response, barge companies are lessening their payloads and traveling less frequently down the river on the way to export terminals like New Orleans. AgriPulse's Noah Wicks reports the cargo restrictions could ultimately lead to barge tows carrying about 10% less cargo for each foot the water level drops. The challenges come at a critical time as companies make their preparations to move billions of bushels of corn, soybeans, and other commodities through Midwest farms to export terminals. Finally, President Joe Biden visited Florida Wednesday to see the damage left behind by Hurricane Ian. It will take weeks to assess full damages to the agricultural sector, but so far, damage to citrus orchards, fall crops, and livestock losses have been reported throughout Florida and the Carolinas. According to USDA, U.S. orange production was estimated to fall 13% before the storm. The storm made landfall in Florida last week before moving north to hit the shores of South Carolina. The vast majority of the damage stayed well south of the North Carolina Republican David Rauser's 7th Congressional District. But he says recovery will be an all-hands-on-deck approach.
Well, the easy part is the immediate recovery, quite frankly. The hard part is the long-term rebuilding after a storm. Of course, we've had a couple hurricanes come through eastern North Carolina since I was elected to office in 2014. Hurricane Matthew, and then again Hurricane Florence, and of course the Gulf has seen more hurricanes than we have, and of course obviously with Ian, very devastating storm for Florida, particularly in that Fort Myers area. Just really tragic images that you see, and our heart really goes out to them because I know what that's like, and the flooding aspect is a very, very difficult component to overcome. Because it just takes everything. It's an emotional toll. It's a physical toll. In many cases, folks won't have homes to move back into for a long time to come. And that gets to the long-term recovery aspect. And Garrett Graves and I have teamed up to try to make some reforms in that realm, as well as Stacy Plackett. And, that's an area we need to prove substantially. Right now, you can wait a long, long time after Congress has appropriated federal dollars for long-term recovery. And the states won't see those dollars for 2, 3, 4 years later because of the bureaucratic quagmire that's in place. So I have legislation that would really simplify the process and take a lot of that bureaucracy out of the equation so that folks can get their get back on their feet, as quickly as possible.
Well, and let's talk about that long-term recovery there, Congressman, because obviously the Farm Bill is coming up. Deliberations and oversight hearings have been taking place to a certain extent on that this year. And one of the things that some folks are suggesting is pursuing some kind of a permanent disaster program as opposed to those ad hoc disaster programs that you were mentioning that can take time for Congress to pass, can take time for administrations to implement. On the subject of a permanent disaster program for agricultural producers, where do you stand on that issue?
Well, I think we need to have a basic program in place that provides immediate relief. But you not only need a good safety net when you have a natural disaster, you need a good safety net when you have exceptional economic difficulty. And of course, these huge increases in input cost are a big problem for farmers all across the board. And I think we need to address that as well. So there's going to be a lot on the table with the Farm Bill. And of course, it expires next September the 30th. We're going to have a lot of work to do when we get the majority in November and get sworn in January 3rd. And I think you'll see us hit the ground running on all those topics and then have a thorough discussion and a complement of ideas to address each. What I was referring to earlier, though, are all the people, and I wasn't talking about agriculture specifically, but all those who have lost homes, business, and everything else. That long-term recovery aspect is critically important, too. I serve on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and we'll be addressing that as well.
Well, and just quickly before we move to a different subject, we'd like to discuss the Supreme Court arguments this week with you as well. But just quickly here on the Hurricane Ian front, some folks are wondering whether or not agricultural disaster assistance is going to be included in the upcoming funding bill in December. But wondering, do you anticipate that Hurricane Ian recovery funding is going to need to be included in the CR later this year as well?
I would expect that there'll be a tranche of funding that's included in the CR or end of the year omnibus bill, if not the CR. And of course, who knows? We might actually get our act together and have an omnibus bill at the time the current CR expires. But I anticipate it'll be extended a week or so, and we'll get an omni done right before Christmas. But yes, I think there probably will be some additional funding included in that. But it does take a little while to get your estimates in. And so we'll just have to see where we are. I think the disaster programs that are in place right now, at least for immediate disaster, are pretty well funded. I think FEMA's got a pretty healthy cash balance. And we'll just see what we need moving forward. On the agriculture front, it can take a little while to really truly know what your losses are. And I anticipate probably we come back in the spring and address that more fully at that point.
We'll be right back to discuss the Supreme Court action on Sackett versus the EPA with Congressman David Rauser right after this.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. The Supreme Court heard arguments this week that could go a long way in determining what exactly is a water of the United States and how the country's wetlands should be regulated. But North Carolina Republican David Rauser says the work should continue no matter what the court decides.
This is an issue that really needs to be resolved by Congress, and it's not an easy issue. You have very different political viewpoints on this, and then you have very different legal viewpoints on this as well, which is what's made it such a quagmire. You obviously have the Obama rule that many all across the country, and I'd say a bipartisan group all across the country were very, very concerned, about the original Obama rule. You had the Trump rule that seemed to satisfy everybody across the board, based on what I can tell, except for your hardcore left-wing environmental groups. And so the court is obviously trying to figure out this question as it relates to wetlands and what should be considered a water of the U.S. From the standpoint of the Sackett property in this particular case. We'll see what they decide. And of course, one thing we're concerned about is that the EPA is going to come out with a new regulation here, a new rule here, basically defining water of the U.S. before this Sackett case is even decided. So we've been pushing back very hard on that. We think that we ought to wait and see what the U.S. Supreme Court decides here. But long term, we've got to have a codification of the rule. And I would prefer a codification of the Trump rule But I think it's really important moving forward that Congress come to some agreement on exactly what is a water of the U.S. So that there's some certainty and landowners, farmers, and others know exactly what they're dealing with.
But if we accept that, desire on your part and accept the prediction that you offered earlier that Republicans are going to take the majority in the House, even if they were to take the majority in the Senate, they're still dealing with a Democratic president. How does that framework work against the goals that you have to codify something into legislation? I mean, I got to imagine that's an uphill battle, Congressman.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I never said it was going to be easy. It's a very even if you had 60 conservatives in the U.S. Senate, it probably would be a difficult task because everybody's got a little bit different viewpoint about what a water of the U.S. Should be, how it should be defined. But I do think there's some likelihood that we can come together as a House and pass a codification out of the House, our version, and we'll see what we can negotiate with the Senate, perhaps even as a policy rider on an appropriations bill at some point next year, or an omni, late next year. So, these issues, just because something's difficult doesn't mean that it doesn't need to be pursued. There really needs to be certainty in this area, and quite honestly, a codification of some sort is very much needed for that purpose.
Lastly, I want to ask you about another case that's on the docket for the Supreme Court here next week. Now, a couple of big foreign policy cases on the court's docket here to start off their term here this October. But the Proposition 12 case that would obviously set animal housing standards for producers looking to sell pork into California, court looking to hear those arguments here on Tuesday. Just wondering, what is at stake for your producers when justices are hearing those arguments?
This is a particular case. I'm going to be really curious to see how the court rules here. I think I know what they're going to do, but I can't prejudge an outcome, obviously. But this is really important for American agriculture. Basically, you had your animal rights groups that want to put animal agriculture completely, totally out of business in this country. They recognize that in North Carolina, Georgia, other states, they're not able to get their to-do list achieved. And so they go to a very liberal state like California, put this referendum on the ballot, and put this proposition on the ballot. And of course, it passes because, those citizens of California, they don't necessarily understand the full scope of consequence for these new animal housing requirements out there. And basically, it would prohibit states like North Carolina and Georgia and other pork producing states or poultry producing states where this protein is harvested and packed and shipped would be banned from sale in California. And it really is a very interesting interstate commerce question, which is the subject of the lawsuit of the case. And we'll see how the court rules. And now, if the court rules in favor of the industry, that's a big win for American agriculture. These processes have been put in place for a reason. They're efficient. They work. You're producing an abundant food supply at the lowest possible cost. And if this decision goes the other way, this proposition is allowed to stand, it's going to have significant ramifications for American agriculture. Food prices are going to go up. There's going to be a less abundance of protein available. And consumers are going to get hit really, really hard. It's going to be very damaging to the country.
Obviously, pork producers in North Carolina across the country are going to be watching that case on Tuesday, as will reporters in Washington, D.C. We'll be keeping a close eye on that one, as well as a very important case for foreign policy. Congressman Rausser, we appreciate you joining us.
Great to be with you.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, our Hannah Pagel hears from a college student interested in an upcoming Supreme Court case in this week's From the Field.
In this week's From the Field, a University of Illinois student wants to know more about the Proposition 12 lawsuit and the impact it has on farmers across the country.
My name is Emma Peters, and I am a junior at the University of Illinois studying Ag Econ focused on policy. My question today is, with California's Prop 12 issue focused on animal housing facing a lot of legal issues and troubles in the courts, how is this affecting farmers all across the country with interstate commerce?
Thanks for the question, Emma. Right now, hog producers will have to wait until the Supreme Court makes a final decision on Proposition 12. Justices are scheduled to hear arguments on the subject on October 11th. If the court upholds Prop 12, farmers across the country would have to change their animal housing standards if they want to sell pork into California's markets. Last summer, the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 3-0 for the state and against a challenge from the National Pork Producers Council and American Farm Bureau, finding that Proposition 12 is neither a price control nor price affirmation statute. However, NPPC says compliance with Prop 12 will cost individual farmers millions of dollars and could potentially drive smaller hog farmers out of business and undermine the overall global competitiveness of the U.S. pork industry. If you'd like to see your question answered on the show, send an email to newsmakers@agripulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel. Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. It's been a busy week in the agricultural law sector, and it's going to be another busy week next week. And we've got a panel of experts here to dissect this week's news and look ahead to what we're going to see next week. Joining us, we have Peggy Kirk-Hall from Ohio State. We have Ben Battles with Paulette Cohen and Travis Cushman with the American Farm Bureau Federation. Appreciate all of you taking the time to join us. And Travis, I want to go to you first here, because obviously it's been a very busy week on the water quality and water protection front with the Clean Water Act before the Supreme Court. Some active discussions in that case. And wondering, you know, what do you make of the dialogue that we saw take place in the court, and how do you think that will eventually influence the outcome that we're going to see from the justices?
Thank you so much. It was a really interesting day. It was a day of many firsts to the court. It was the first day, it was back in 3 years in session, in person. It was the first day with this new format they had, and it was also the first day with the new Justice Jackson. Takeaways, they were all, I think, very excited to be back in person again. But in particular, I don't think that this significant nexus test the government was trying to back is going to stay. I think there was definitely a majority of justices that were not willing to accept that significant nexus standard that the Department of Justice was defending. And I also think that that means that there will be a new standard going forward.
Well, from my observer's chair, it seemed as if a lot of the discussion that was going on in those arguments had to do with what particular test the government should be employing to define the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. And Ben, that's where I want to bring you in, because you were the lead counsel on a brief that included a pretty wide coalition ranging from Latino farmers organizations to craft brewers organizations. And one of the things that that particular amicus brief pushed for was a brief that was in line with congressional intent. So what does that coalition think such a test would look like?
Thank you. I think the major concern of the coalition that I represented was a substantial weakening of the Clean Water Act and of the significant nexus test. And I think rather than advocating for a specific test, what my clients were really looking for was clarity from the court and a durable standard. And they have been operating under some variation of the significant nexus test for quite a number of years. So their major concern was that the court might adopt the continuous service connection test that was advocated by the petitioners, and that the result of that would be a substantial weakening of the protections of the Clean Water Act.
Well, and Peggy, I had the opportunity to read an analysis of the situation that you authored prior to these arguments, and I want to read a passage of it that you wrote. You offered a prediction that the court will not only set aside the Ninth Circuit's application of the significant nexus test, but will also adopt Justice Scalia's test as the proper way to determine when a wetland is a water of the U.S. and subjects to a jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. We've heard the arguments now. Is that a prediction you stand behind with a little bit more information to work from?
Well, I should clarify, I was reporting what many others were predicting. rather than myself, but I don't think that's where we'll see the court go now that we've heard the arguments. They were extremely focused on the adjacency issue under 1344G, which I think caught many by surprise. And it seems that they will develop something around that issue rather than going to either the significant nexus or the Scalia test.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back. The issue of properly defining a water of the United States is an issue that has come before multiple administrations and courts in recent farm policy memory. When we spoke to our panel, we asked Ben Battles, is finality and certainty possible from this court?
I think the court was really struggling with defining the exact test. But part of the uncertainty is that the regulations advanced by the EPA and the Corps for the past several years have been continuously tied up in litigation. So I think that the certainty would come if the court allows the EPA and the Corps to finalize and enforce the regulations. And I think that's what, you know, our clients are really looking for. And obviously that's what the EPA is looking for as well.
But if the court were to allow the EPA to move forward, I mean, would those, could it potentially employ a scenario where those regulations that the EPA and the Corps were to develop and enforce be still subject to additional legal scrutiny?
Certainly, with a new rule will likely come new litigation. But the hope is, from our perspective at least, that the court, you know, makes a clear statement of the EPA's authority in this space to advance regulations based on its expertise that, you know, adequately consider the, you know, the physical connections of a wetland to, traditionally navigable river or lake.
So a lot of discussion here so far in this discussion about the Sackett versus EPA case, but that's really not the only case that the Supreme Court will be taking up with big implications for farm policy within the first week of its term here. Also expecting Prop 12 litigation to take place on Tuesday. That Prop 12 is, of course, a language from the state of California regarding animal housing, specifically in this case, in the pork sector. Travis, obviously there's been some discussion on Prop 12 going back for months and years. Even folks can Google our publication and the words Prop 12 and find quite a bit to look at. But what do you take from just kind of the temperature of the Supreme Court arguments that we saw on Monday with the Sackett case? And how do you think that's going to influence the reception that the Prop 12 arguments will get in the room here on Tuesday?
Yeah, well, it certainly shows that the justices are very interested in diving down into the nitty-gritty of the implications of any kind of rule they would come out with. So I think we'll see some very good questions from all nine justices on the issue. At the previous argument, we had the government arguing on the other side of the petitioners here. In our case, fortunately, we have the government arguing with us as well. So we will have both us and the government explaining why this California law is unconstitutional and places undue burdens on interstate commerce.
And so when we discuss the fact that there are some legal obstacles to Prop 12, obviously there is a lawsuit being filed against it that is raised to the level of being argued before the high court. But Peggy, I want to bring you in here as we wrap up our discussion. What do you think the justices will need to consider, just from a strictly legal analysis standpoint? What do you think the justices will need to consider as they look to render a ruling?
I think they'll need to take a hard look at the upstream impacts. That's something that the Ninth Circuit acknowledged, that there are definite upstream impacts from this California Proposition 12, but they still focused entirely on the discriminatory effect. And I think we'll see that broaden and we'll have the analysis of both. Is there a discriminatory intent, but also a further look at that impact that this law has on producers in other states beyond California's borders.
So obviously that's a case that a lot of folks have been watching for as I mentioned, quite a long time. Folks looking to those arguments taking place on Tuesday for a little bit more information on just how the Supreme Court will be looking to issue its ruling, and not expecting rulings anytime soon in either particular case, something that we expect to come here in 2023. And we'll be sure to be discussing this issue with the panelists that we have joining us here this week, as well as many, many others as we look to follow and analyze the news yet to come. But for now, I think that's going to do it for this week's discussion panel. Appreciate you joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse newsmakers, but first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at American agricultural exports in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Agriculture's share of total U.S. export value rose to a new high in 2021. This chart from USDA shows agriculture's share of total U.S. export values from 2002 to projected totals in 2023. Overall, American export dollars reached a record high of $1.4 trillion in fiscal year 2021. Agricultural exports accounted for 12% of that, 9% higher than what we saw in 2002. USDA says China, Mexico, and Canada are big demand drivers for U.S. agriculture and are typically among the top three importers across different products. Agricultural exports jumped 23% last year to $172 billion due to increased demand for grains and feed, as well as oilseeds and animal products. USDA expects this year to produce a record of $196 billion in ag exports, and value is projected to remain strong in 2023 due to increases in corn, cotton, and soybean shipments. It's also important to note the relationship between export volume and export value. If U.S. commodity prices continue to rise, that might mean fewer bushels go overseas. But the overall dollar figure could continue to go up. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The Supreme Court will hear arguments in a challenge to California's Prop 12 rule on Tuesday. Wednesday is Report Day at the Department of Agriculture, as a new World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates is due out, along with a monthly crop production report. We'll also be keeping a close eye on the latest release of the Consumer Price Index on Thursday. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for all of this and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.